Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and this is my podcast for people who would like to be outdoors, but for obvious reasons right now are, if you like, confined to home. My guest today has had a glittering military career, and he went on to become, I think, probably one of the most experienced Himalayan climbers around. He's had well over 20 Himalayan expeditions to his credit, and obviously a vast experience in leading and organizing expeditions. He's here today to talk about his book and his life in the mountains to a degree. His book is called The Storms, Adventure and Tragedy on Everest, which recounts what happened on Everest 25 years ago, those tragic events when around eight people lost their lives. So I think it be very interesting to hear the story of that. So if I need to introduce, bring it to the show now, Mike Truman. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Hi, John. Well, thank you.
Good, good, good. If you don't mind, I had a look at your book, and much to my amazement, it's a mountaineering book that starts on a boat. How did that happen?
I was training to be a helicopter pilot, John, in the late 70s, and my instructor needed someone to help him ship his boat, which he'd bought from Northern Ireland, to Gosport on the south coast of England. And I had been a keen sailor up to my helicopter pilot days, so I volunteered to help him during our summer holiday. It was a one-week trip. But during the trip, we got stuck in what then became known as the Fastnet storm. And we, the two of us, were fairly lucky to survive.
Right.
We weren't as far out as others, but we were lucky in events as they unfolded.
Yeah, well, you were caught in what sounds like an horrendous storm. I suppose the link is that storms are both mountain and at sea are the link with your book. How did your interest in mountaineering develop?
Well, I joined the army as a boy soldier, John, at the age of 16. I escaped my grammar school and went off to do what I thought would be a more exciting adventures. And during the time as a boy soldier, we had regular adventure training stints, canoeing, mountaineering. I had, I suppose, a sort of a natural aptitude for it. I certainly enjoyed it more than I did lots of the other things I did at the time.
Right.
And I went off and did an Outward Bound course at the old mountain army Outward Bound school in Wales, and did reasonably well. And then ended up instructing 2 or 3 years later.
Right. So okay. So it was your military career that really got you into that. So what led you? What events then led you to be on Everest in 1996?
Well, it was at that time I'd actually left the army. My last job in the army, I commanded the Army Mountain Training Centre in Germany, which was 2 years of pleasure, and they could have left me there if I had decided. But I retired and went off and worked in Hong Kong. But the thirst to go back and climb was with me. And I was fortunate enough to be able to get sponsored in 96. So I went back and signed up with Mal Duff, who I had known for some time.
Right.
And who put together, actually at the time, compared with the price of lots of other expeditions, Mal's expeditions were well priced, and mainly for people who were experienced climbers. And we paid, I know in 96, for example, we paid, or Mal paid for his permit, $50,000 for the South Polish South Billow route. Compared with $70,000 for the normal route.
Right. Okay.
Well, so good deal, basically.
Okay. Can you describe to the South Billow route to us, because that's not something I'm familiar with.
Well, to be fair, and this is where Mal was very canny. The South Billow route, it's the normal route up to Camp 3.
Right.
And then at Camp 3, instead of going straight up, and left to the yellow band and then up to the South Col. Uh-huh. You cut left across the Lhotse face and up what is it's termed the pillar, the ridge,
right.
up to what then actually joins the South Col So it's like a diversion that then joins the normal route and costs $20,000 less. So I think that was it's not necessarily a lot harder. I suppose technically a bit more difficult, but I don't want to play its hardness over the normal route. It's just an alternative.
So it's a variation that perhaps will be a little less crowded as well, I guess.
Completely. I don't know what people didn't cotton onto the fact it was cheaper, but we're quite pleased they didn't.
Okay. As we all know, that it ended in tragedy. But tell us a little. Can you tell us the story of this expedition as far as you can in the sort of 10 or 15 minutes that we've got?
Well, I mean, briefly to start off with, I mean, we were all watching before we all went to Everest with the South African debacle, where a guy called Ian Woodward, who I'd met previously in the military times, had led a South African team in, sponsored by the Times of South Africa, who mutinied on the way in. And this was, they'd gone in a lot earlier than the rest of us. I remember it, before he even left UK, watching the stirrings of what obviously turned out to be quite an unusual season. I arrived in early April after the rest of the team. In fact, one of our English team members had already left the expedition before I got there. He took one look at the icefall and left the camp.
Wow. Okay. And what was different about the icefall then that you didn't expect?
I don't think a lot was different at all that year. I think a lot of expeditions, I think it's still true nowadays, is that the people sign up, and to be fair, Mal had most of the team were experienced, but the one or two less experienced people. And a lot of people sign up, pay all the money, and then get to Everest and suddenly realize, you know, what the icefall is all about. And it is, for people not very experienced, it's quite a
right.
sight
right.
when you see
right.
it.
Okay. Okay, I can understand that. So, So what happened what happened next?
Well, the rest of the expedition proceeded. Well, I just say proceeded normally, and we had two icefall rescues. One on the 20th of April, when Ginge Fulham, one of our team members, a Royal Navy diver who'd got the Queen's Gallantry Medal on the Herald of Free Enterprise when he'd gone in and saved some trapped. And Ginge had a heart attack at the top of the icefall. And he had to be brought down. And then on the 30th of April, one of our Danish team members, again an experienced climber, somehow fell in the icefall, broke his ribs and badly damaged his knee, and he had to be brought down. So we'd had a couple of near misses fairly early on the expedition. Ginge fortunately recovered from the heart attack, went on to climb the highest peaks in Africa and Europe. So I'm glad to say that they both survived.
Right, okay.
Wasn't going to happen later. And then on the 3rd of May, I was paired with a Finnish climber, Jaakko Kervinen.
Right.
And we were up with another pair, including Vika Gustafsson, who at the time was intending to try all the 14 8,000 meter peaks without oxygen, which he did achieve later on.
Right.
We could also climb K2 and Everest by then. So the four of us went up to Camp 2 to wait for a summit attempt. But people have heard of the Khumbu cough, and it's where the high altitude just gets, the air gets on the back of the throat. No, to be fair, that year, I'd gone with a fairly bad chest, and it got worse in the 4 days I was at base camp Camp 2 waiting for an attempt on the summit. And on the, having gone on the 3rd of May, on the 7th of May, I'd simply had to go back down to get treatment, or else I wasn't going to get any higher on the mountain.
Right, okay. And you had to come down and basically, get a break from being at high altitude. Is that more or less what you had to do?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I came down, all I wanted to do was try and dose myself with as much medicine as possible. And I remember on the way down to the ice floor meeting Scott Fisher, one of the big team leaders, or leader of one of the two big teams coming up through the ice floor. We swapped some banter, and Scott said he had a bad chest as well. But, he was leading a team which was paying him a lot of money to get them to the top. I was lucky. I was doing my own thing, really. I went back to base camp and unfortunately rested and got some medicine.
Yeah.
And then I went back up on the 10th of May which was the day that Scott's team, the Mountain Madness, and the other big team on the mountain, Adventure Consultants, led by Rob Hall, were going for the summit.
Right.
Rob had summited four times before, and all between the 9th and the 12th of May. And I can only assume, because a couple of weeks earlier, teams had been warned to stay clear of the mountain during that period.
Right.
So that Rob could, as he thought each year, have another go at the mountain when he felt the weather was traditionally suitable. And he then got together with Scott Fisher, both teams with lots of clients paying a lot of money, decided to go for the summit that during that period. I arrived there on the 10th as they were ascending up. That day they were due to be, I mean, most people try and summit on the mountain before 12 o'clock. It's an unwritten law. If you don't get to the top of Everest by 12, which, you know, you should really be turning back. Mm-hmm. Because of, you know, the onset of darkness and the lack of oxygen for those who are using it. And when I got to Camp 2 quite quickly that day, and from 1 p.m. we were starting to be concerned, because we looked up, you can see the Hillary Step from Camp 2.
Right.
And we could see a long line of climbers still waiting to go up through the Hillary Step. The weather then deteriorated. 4 p.m. it was shocking. And we had no communications from the summit or the area, so we didn't really know what was happening. But
yeah.
At 6 p.m. we learned that Rob Hall was stuck with one of his clients, Doug Hansen, near the summit. And clearly we all started to become very concerned. And the weather, really, you looked up, it was awful. It was rolling in darkness. I mean, right. It got dark before sunset, very dark.
Okay.
And it was like looking at a firework display up above us. That evening, we know that there were some people at the South Coast, some communications were getting through that people were getting to the South Coast.
Right.
But we later found out that the last climber who managed to get back to the South Coast didn't get back until 4:30 the following morning. Having been away from the south, from Camp 4 on the South Pole for 30 hours and at least 10 hours without oxygen for those who are obviously using supplementary. But whether you're using it or not, even those who were climbing without it by that stage of the game would have been hard pushed.
I mean, that were hard pushed is from what you were saying. I mean, I mean, to be away from at that altitude in that weather for that kind of time sounds almost unbelievable, really.
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think, you know, we know eventually that 8 people died, but when you look at the conditions that were in, it's surprising that a lot more people hadn't died. And I mentioned the 4:30, but at 5:30, I remember we were all up and dressed at Camp 2. And there were a lot of people, experienced people at Camp 2, fortunately. It was full of not me, but many of the other people were top-notch climbers.
Right.
And, you know, fortunately, as events turned out, at least the rescuers were in the right place at the right time.
So how did events unfold after that, then?
Well, there were 6 guys with the teams above us. We knew that. But fairly early on, 3 of the guys were out of action. We knew that Rob Hall was still at the South Summit. That was being relayed to us. We knew that we'd heard that Scott Fisher was missing. He hadn't summited until 3:40 on the 10th of May. And Anatoly Bukharev, who was one of the really hard climbers of that age, but he decided to climb as a guide without oxygen. And he was being paid to guide people because he didn't have any oxygen. He was climbing without supplementary oxygen. He'd already gone back to the South Col fairly early that day. So 3 of the 6 guides that were with those teams were already out of action, which was obviously leading to some problems, because climbers, paying clients, were having to find their way back down, basically, to the South Col. And we knew by about 6 o'clock that Rob Hall was still with Doug Hansen at the We thought near the South Summit, but we did think Doug was dead by this stage because of other various messages we were getting. I was no more experienced than anyone at Camp 2, but because I served in the Gurkhas throughout my time in the army and spoke Nepalese, we thought it'd be a good job for someone to go back to base camp. It was basically base camp, no Zoom base camp, except the volunteers who were manning the radios and looking after the camp itself. All the climbers were up at Camp 2 or above.
It became a kind of control centre, is that?
Yeah, I did very much, and I had to, because really we had to talk to the outside world, and we knew we had on the morning of the 11th of May, we thought we had 23 climbers above the, or missing, or unaccounted for. We had an idea where some were, but we'd had no definite news where people were. So in effect, there were 23 people in varying states above us, and we didn't know how bad they were. So we thought that we needed help with the outside world at least, and also the radio systems, because we were all on different radios, we needed a point at base camp news could be focused through. So I, at 7 o'clock on the 11th of May, was asked to go back down to coordinate the rescue from base camp. And I was fortunate. I mean, it took me a long time to get down, to be fair. My physical state, and we come back up the day before and I'm still suffering. I did record taking a long time. But fortunately, when I got there, Guy Cotter, who had previously worked with Rob Hall, and with Adventure Consultants, was on Pumori, and he came over to help out at base camp. And really, the two of us worked together with Caroline McKenzie, the doctor of Rob Hall's team. Perversely, John, the amount of money that Adventure Consultants were paying for the fairly luxurious glamping organisation they had at base camp actually served to be beneficial, because we used their fantastic communication systems and their roomy base camp tent for the meetings, which then had to start to coordinate the support for those carrying out the rescue above.
So it sounds as though by this point, though, you're in a fairly desperate situation. Well, not particularly you personally, but obviously the people on the mountain, because you've got what sounds like atrocious weather, and you've got a lot of people unaccounted for.
Absolutely, John. I mean, we knew we had two dead, although that I'll mention in a second, that changed. And those two bodies were at the South Col. And we knew, as the day went on the 10th of May, we knew Rob was obviously still stuck at the South Summit when the messages were coming through to him. And he was packed through to his, from our tent, Adventure Consultants, packed through to his wife, Jan Arnold, who was in New Zealand.
Right.
To encourage him to come down. But clearly Rob was getting in a worse state and turned out couldn't move. and elsewhere on the mountain, communications were still fairly atrocious. It wasn't until two climbers, Pete Athens, who's one of the most experienced Everest climbers ever, and Todd Burleson, reached the South Col late in the midday, really, on the 11th of May, that communication started to improve. But we knew we still had a very serious situation to sort out.
Yes. So how did you get people down the mountain then?
Well, initially we thought we didn't know how we were going to get them down the mountain.
Right.
We had visions of sort of, right at the start when we thought we had 21 missing, because I mean one of the we'd already someone had died. A Tom Hughes climber died on the way up, and his body had been brought down in the while the storm was really occurring, and it took 8 Sherpas to carry down that one body. Yeah. You can imagine if we had to carry lots of people down through the ice fall, how many Sherpas and clients, that was going to take.
Almost impossible, really, yeah. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, totally, John. And we looked at all different options. One was actually considering even asking the Nepalese army to come and help. I'd gone away from the Gurkhas for a short period to fly helicopters, and Guy Cotter suggested we use helicopters, but I was a bit dubious. In 1973, a helicopter supported the the Italian army on Everest, and one had crashed in the Western Coombs. So it wasn't thought to be a particularly good place.
Yes, but in those days, you'd be pushing the sort of altitude envelope for a helicopter. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, 5,000 meters was generally in the old days considered, certainly with British Army helicopters, was about as high as you could get without them not working. And we were lucky that we put the idea through to Kathmandu, and a Nepalese army colonel said, yeah, I'll have a go with a squirrel helicopter. So we started to focus on using a helicopter to get people down. As it turned out, of the 21, and I mentioned the two dead at the South Col, one of them wasn't dead.
Right, yes.
When the two rescuers got out of there, Todd and Pete Athens, to improve communications, later that afternoon, across the South Col, they saw this person walking with his arm, frozen arm, stuck up in the air. It turned out to be Beck Weathers, who'd come to and dug himself out of his icy grave. But astonishing, and they thought Bet was going to die. I mean, he was put in a tent while the rest of the rescue continued. And it wasn't until the following morning, on the 12th of May, that they realised that Bet hadn't died, and that he was still surviving. So we knew we had Bet to bring down. We also Makalu Gao, a Taiwanese climber, who had been found near where Scott Fisher was, just above the South Col. And Scott, sadly, was close to death, and they triaged both the Taiwanese Makalu and Scott, and left Scott.
Right.
And Makalu actually was recovered quite remarkably. And we knew then from the sort of the late on the 11th of May that in all likelihood, we had five dead on our side, and we had two seriously injured climbers who had to be brought down. But luckily, the rest seemed to be able to manage their own evacuation down the mountain.
Right. So although eight people losing their lives is obviously very tragic, it could have been a lot worse, really.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I mentioned five on our side and three died on the other side of the mountain. It could have been extremely far worse. I mean, I look back on those days now and sort of shudder that how we got away with it. I mean, there are all sorts of things. I mean, this storm, we were watching weather on around Everest. We got forecasts from the Royal Air Force at Bracknell into our camp. But what we hadn't, and it seems obvious now, but then we didn't think it so much. We didn't look at what was beyond, out coming in towards Everest, and this vast storm had been building out over the Bay of Bengal. And the reason I mention that is because as the storm comes in, it lowers the pressure, and what little oxygen you've got even less in the air. So, whilst all this was going on, all the conditions were working against the people who we were trying to rescue. We were incredibly lucky, only that eight people sadly died, but that was in retrospect quite a fortunate number to die.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in terms of it's a quarter of a century ago now, I suppose, but at the time, I was quite surprised when I read it, part of your account, just how inexperienced some of those teams were. That surely has to have been a factor in all this.
Well, I think it was. I mean, there's several factors, and obviously the weather I've described, we weren't looking
at
what was happening. But the other factor, funnily enough, the two teams, Scott Fisher's team and Rob Wolf's team, I think there was a lot of criticism, undue criticism, because they weren't that bad. I mean, there was one female that was picked out, but this was her seventh summit that she was climbing.
Right, and so she was far, far from a novice then, you know?
Completely, and what the novice teams were the South African team who decided that they'd ignored the request to stay off the mountain.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they were tagging along behind Rob Hall, and the Taiwanese climbers were also a similar lack of experience. But to be fair, most of those people on the mountain were reasonably experienced. The problem is, I think it's where the lessons have been learned nowadays. This was relative infancy of commercially guided expeditions. And you have a choice with six guides. You can either split the teams into groups depending on their speed, their ability on the mountain. And then the fastest groups, so natural selection, the fastest groups can go on at their own speed to the summit.
Yes.
But for some reason, I think because this was in the infancy and they were worried about the clients and wanted to look after them, they over-pampered them. They kept them together and they all moved at the speed of the slowest climber. Yeah, so summiting at reasonable times, nobody summited before 1 p.m. On the 10th of May. Mm. They were setting themselves in, putting themselves into a difficult situation anyway. Clearly, they weren't at that stage aware of the storm that was going to cause even more mayhem than later.
Even so, though, as you know, high altitude speed is safety, isn't it?
Yeah, speed and safety. I think that not so much the speed in this. I mean, that when you consider people like, for example, Bette Weathers had been left at the balcony fairly early on in their ascent because he had an eye problem.
Yes.
And there were other people there. They may have been relatively experienced. I mean, take away the criticism of being inexperienced climbers. Mm-hmm, they weren't necessarily as fit. And, you know, like any situation, even the best climbers are slow for a particular amount of time, so they were always moving. Whoever was the slowest climber, they were always moving at the speed of that person because they tried to herd two large teams up the mountain. If they split into smaller groups, who could have moved faster. Speed is probably I'm using the wrong word, but it's certainly moving faster than the other.
Yes, group. Yes, I appreciate they that.
Created space and perhaps wouldn't have been so serious the outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, some people, I think in your book, you said some people were waiting for 90 minutes and things like that. And, that's a long time to be hanging around there, isn't it?
Well, it is, John. I think the other thing, of course, I mean, what has changed now is we've got to remember in 96, the oxygen systems were awful. I mean, by compared with what they use now.
Yeah.
And, you know, people, they often didn't work and they often partially worked. You weren't getting into the flow you
wanted. Yes, yes.
So, people couldn't, you know, people in a queue in 96 is very different from people who see these pictures now, people queuing in whatever year, the recent years.
Yes,
and, yes. You know, I think that, you know, that's great. I'm delighted that the systems have got better. But the smaller teams, and there were a lot less people there in 1996.
Right.
But as you mentioned, the queuing and the fact that they're queuing and the oxygen systems weren't necessarily, everything was going against them.
And it was the first time
really on the mountain and we'd seen these sort of queues. So nothing compared with now.
And do you think that lessons have been learned? I mean, climbing Everest will never be completely safe, but is it safer than it was then?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I use statistics on this, John, taking Brits as an example, I mean, up until first Brits climbed in 75 to the summit, and by 25 years later, in 2000, 42 Brits had reached the summit. I was number 39.
Right.
So 42 of us in that period had climbed, and there have been a number of deaths. And the ratio of summits to deaths was one death to 7.5 summits.
Right.
Between 2000 and 2010, another 168 Brits had reached the summit with only three deaths.
Right, okay.
Ratio of 1 to 56.
So it's changing dramatically then.
Dramatic changes. And I think two things. Firstly, a lot of lessons were learned in 96 about how the speed of climbers going to the summit. Oxygen systems in the early 2000s, as a result of the RAF Ted Atkins development of what was available, made climbing much safer, and you could stay for longer periods above 8,000 meters.
Right. So I mean, it sounds to me actually as though 96 might have been a bit of a turning point. Really, it sounds as though it was it happened at least in the tragedy that happened at least in part because I suppose commercial ascents of the mountain, if you like to call them that, were relatively new at that sort of level, that number of folk. And perhaps what we've learned from that is how to manage those things better. Would that be true, do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think you know, there were lessons there. It was something waiting to happen. It could have, you know, perhaps with a bit more thought, it could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the suddenly people realise that they can make a lot of money out of taking people to the summit. And unlike previous expeditions, where to get a climber to the top, just one climber, made the expedition successful, when you started becoming commercial or introducing commercial expeditions, everyone expected to get to the top. So you had to completely organize, disorganize the way the expedition is done previously to give everyone a chance.
Yeah.
And to do that safely, it was bound to take some time, I think, until we developed better ways of doing it.
Yeah. So do you think, what are your ambitions now? There's still things that you'd like to do?
Yeah, I'd like to trek with my grandchildren now, actually.
Yes, well, that's a...
Well, I went back to Nepal 4-5 years ago now.
I checked
with my who was then my granddaughter for her 8th birthday. We've still got another five grandchildren. I'd certainly like to trek and perhaps ski with them.
That'd be fantastic, wouldn't it? Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, well, let's hope. Obviously, we're in the middle of the. Let's hope we're not in the middle of a pandemic. Let's hope we're seeing a pandemic coming to its end. Although it doesn't feel very much like that, you know. So I wonder how things are going to go in the future. I certainly can't see things like alpine huts opening up anytime soon. So anyway, your book, The Storms, Adventure and Tragedy on Everest, sounds a fascinating tale of what was sounds to me like a pivotal event in Himalayan mountaineering, really.
I think so, John. And I would say I look back on it with all sorts of thoughts, mixed thoughts, obviously missing some of the people we were with. Another 7 people who were actually with us on the mountain have died not long afterwards. So, yeah, it was a very strange time, but... I suppose what adventure is all about. There are moments where things change for the better.
I suppose that's true. That's a very good summation of it in a way. In that there is a dark side of adventure, and there, I suppose, is a bright side too. Let's hope we can move more towards that. Well, it was a fascinating discussion. Thanks very much for that. And I certainly hope you have a lot of fun with your grandchildren skiing and walking in the Himalayas from now on. Thanks very much, Mike. Very nice to speak to you,
John. Thanks so much. Thank you.
And a big thanks to Mike Truman for coming on the show. Bit of exciting news now. My 4th book, Wild Winter, which will very, very shortly be released on an unsuspecting public. I think it's on the 1st of April, is now also available as an audio book. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that myself, actually. I'll put a wee link on the podcast page. For those of you who don't know, Wild Winter is basically, I suppose, in a way, my diary through the winter of 2019 into 20. And the book was supposed to sort of come into March and April and May, but unfortunately, COVID had a different idea. So when I set out to write the book, I didn't really realize that, to be honest, that winter was going to be like no other winter I'd ever experienced. And I don't suppose any of us did. But anyway, listen, big thing is, if you want to listen to that book, if you're new to Audible, it'll cost you nothing. You can join Audible and they'll give you a first book. Is for the princely sum of nowt. So that's quite, you can't really say, I can't say fairer than that, can I really? So I do hope you've enjoyed this little episode of Outside In, and I'll be speaking to you again soon. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.